The case is taken under advisement. Our next case this morning is Taylor against the Comptroller's Office.
May I proceed?
Mr. Watson.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Chuck Watson, as you already know. I represent Dorothy Taylor, plaintiff, in a race discrimination case against the State of Illinois Office of the Comptroller. Ms. Taylor had been an employee of the Comptroller's Office for a number of years when she was improperly laid off and, pursuant to a union negotiated deal, was brought back on board and restarted with the Comptroller's Office in January of 1998. She came back to a different place, a much different place. She was placed into an obligations unit. Obligations unit is one of the units of the Comptroller's Office that's involved in dealing with lapse period appropriations and whether or not bills should be paid when they're presented during that period of time after the end of a fiscal year, among other duties. She re-entered under a new job classification because her old one had been abolished in the interim, and she was an office assistant, one of three, the only African-American in the entire unit. Of the three office assistants, one had a job that was clearly different than anybody else's. She was on the computer almost all day long, dealing with things that required the use of that. She was also doing things such as reception-type duty, etc. She was clearly different than the other two office assistants. Another Caucasian office assistant, Gary Hubbs, had a job description, a formal job description, that was different than hers in only 5% of the time.
Is it your position that federal civil rights laws required duties to match job descriptions in bureaucracies?
Absolutely not.
So that any two people who have the same job description have to have the same real duties?
No, I think that's the state's position. My position is that the real job, the job on the ground, which it controls. In this case, my client had the same job as everybody else in the unit, clearly the same job as Gary Hubbs, but she was moved in, and she was moved into a position that was untenable. She wasn't given the tools to do her job. She was moved in a physical space designed to incur the wrath of everybody else who used the resources of this office. She was forced to rant and rail in order to get the tools needed to do her job, the real on-the-ground job, the job that stands unrebutted by the state. When she got there, she was put at a folding table that had been used by the rest of the unit as a mail sorting place and a place to hold files that were ready to be filed. She had no phone. She had no computer. Despite the fact that people coming to this unit ask for help from the unit that requires, or at least is greatly aided by the use of a computer, that passing on the information found in files requires the use of the phone. She had to go ask other members of the unit to use their phone.
But this situation, counsel, was only temporary. Isn't that the fact, the undisputed fact?
Yes and no. There is no evidence in the record that it was ever intended to be temporary. The only reason it was temporary is because she pushed it and pushed it hard.
But notwithstanding, it was temporary.
Well, yes.
So minor inconveniences for a temporary period of time. How is that actionable?
Well, I think the cases that talk about minor inconveniences that are temporary in time are talking about where it was intended to be temporary. There's nothing in front of this court, there's nothing in the record to indicate that it was ever intended to be temporary. It was only when she complained that it became temporary. And in fact, it took more than a year just to get a phone. If it was intended to be temporary, why was the phone that and the computer and the desk that was available when she got on the unit not used? There's no reason for a temporary analysis here. The resources were there. A couple weeks after she got on the unit, another employee left, leaving two desks, two phones, and two computers free to be used. They weren't given to her. She had to push for them. It appears to me that the state fully intended this to be a permanent situation. may perhaps based upon the formal job description as it may perhaps cover or may perhaps entirely intentionally, I don't know. I can tell you that on the job required her to do this, and she had the push to get it done. That's not a temporary situation. It only is temporary from her own efforts to remedy the situation. The state makes that argument. Minor inconvenience, temporary systems. The state didn't have that intent, and it wasn't minor. When they finally did get her a desk, they put it in the. They put it, mind you, with two empty desks open, they finally gave her a partial desk and placed in a situation, in a physical situation that required her to get up every time somebody wanted to use the files. This was calculated to humiliate the person when they got in there. The state makes a point that now, even if that's the case, even if all these things are true, there's nothing about this circumstantial case that points directly to race discrimination. And I wish I had something that was, you know, a joke, a comment, anything like that, and I don't. What I do have is comparable treatment or incomparable treatment between comparable people except for one thing, her skin color. She came in and she was the only person treated this way. Even the temporary employees who came in for only part of a year were given the equipment they needed to do their job, which the state testified, former supervisor of my client testified, the temporaries did the same job as my client. They got their equipment within days, including the training to use them, which is an issue here as well. The circumstantial evidence here leads to may perhaps more than one conclusion. But that's the essence of why we have jury trials. This evidence leads us to the conclusion that the state's explanations may not be credible. In fact, you know, I think they are inherently incredible to say that we only intended this to be temporary, when in fact there's no indication that they ever intended that. When they say, well, she had a different job description, when in fact on the ground she had the same job. When in fact the equipment was there and available to be used and they didn't let her use it. And I'm well into my rebuttal time, so absent any other questions at this point, I'll reserve.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Mr. Watson. Mr. Langer.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Brett Langer. I'm an Assistant Illinois Attorney General, and I represent the Defendant Illinois Comptroller's Office in this matter. Your Honors, this Court should affirm the District Court's grant of summary judgment to the Comptroller because Taylor failed to establish a prima facie case of race discrimination under Title VII. In essence, Taylor's claims in this case are about office aesthetics and the ability of a supervisor to assign duties within the employee's job description to the employees in the office. At most, this case involves the micromanagement of a government office, which is simply something that this Court is not in the business of controlling or overseeing. First, Taylor failed to establish that she suffered an adverse employment action in this case. Under Title VII, an adverse employment action is a high standard to meet. The adverse employment action must be more than a mere inconvenience or alteration of job responsibilities. The adverse employment action must materially alter the terms and conditions of employment. The adverse employment action must be a tangible job consequence in the nature of hiring, firing, demotion, loss of pay, or some other significant diminishment of job responsibilities. That simply is not present here. To begin with, the complaint of actions did not constitute a material alteration or a significant change in employment status. The majority of Taylor's time, per her job description, per the way the office runs, was to be spent filing. The vast majority was to be spent filing. There's no indication that she was unable to file. That is the crux of what her job was. That was the essence of her job. There are no facts to indicate that she couldn't do her filing. She admits on page 17 of her opening brief that, in fact, she could do most of her job duties. That includes her primary duty, filing. All work she was assigned to do, all work that she did, was within her job description. The fact that an employee may wish that she was assigned other tasks also within her job description does not mean that there's a civil rights violation in this case. This court held so in the Rhodes case versus IDOT, and it's also similar to the trailer case also versus IDOT. Indeed, the computer work that she claims she was discriminated against because she did not receive was at best a minor part of her position. Her formal job description does not even explicitly list computer work as one of her duties. Furthermore, in her testimony, she described the computer work she did. She would go onto a screen and hit Shift F12 or F12. That is not the major part of her job. Additionally, the complaint of actions were simply temporary inconveniences. Temporary inconveniences do not rise to the level of adverse employment actions under Title VII. First, she complains of her workspace. But her workspace, she always had a workspace from the time she started. She had an area at the table, and that was within the office. It is true she got a desk in July 1998 after she asked for one. And then she complained that she didn't like the placement of it in the office. But she had a workplace the entire time. The computer she received in July 1998, 6 months after she started in the office, she received the computer in August 1998, at the beginning of August, 6 months after she started her employment, but just a few weeks after she requested a computer for the first time of her supervisor. Additionally, though she didn't have a telephone on her desk until 1999, she had the use of any available telephone in her office. And there's no evidence indicating that whenever she needed to pick up the phone and make a call, she couldn't do it. Also, Your Honors, this case needs to be viewed in light of the fact that she came into an office and there were incumbents in the office. It stands to reason that people are going to be set up or established in the office when a new person comes in. It took some time for her to be fully integrated. That's true, but that's not tantamount to a civil rights claim. Before you this morning, opposing counsel has argued that that the state did not intend it to be temporary. Intent is not part of the inquiry here. Intent may go to pretext, which is not before this court. The only thing before this court is whether the temporary inconveniences add up to an adverse employment action. Whether the state intended that to be a permanent or a temporary situation is simply not at issue unless we get to the pretext question, which we need not get to in this case. And finally, Your Honors, no material harm befell Taylor. She did not receive a demotion. She did not receive negative performance evaluations. There was no evidence that she was not able to get a promotion because of the duties assigned to her, and she received raises that were consistent with the other employees in her office. In the end, Your Honors, Taylor did not have a computer, but received one a few weeks after she requested one. Taylor had a workspace from the office, and then she got a desk, but then she complained she didn't like the placement. Taylor had a phone available to her that she could use whenever she wanted. Taylor could do her primary job, which was filing. This simply was not a material alteration of the terms and conditions of her employment sufficient to state a claim under Title VII. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Counsel. Anything further, Mr. Watson?
Intent is everything in discrimination law. If they didn't intend it to be permanent, that's one thing. If they intended to be permanent, it's entirely a different thing. Intent is all. We don't want to miss in this case the elephant for all its parts. You can go through each individual complaint, each individual part of this, and maybe adequately explain why something happened, or at least provide an explanation. That's all the state has to do at this point is provide an explanation. Nobody's asking it to prove it. But when you have to do that with thing after thing after thing after thing, and all of these things that need explaining only apply to one, the only African-American in the office, it raises a question of whether or not this was intentional discrimination. This is the mirror of the parrot man in a closet case. If a professional is harmed by putting him in an office that's a closet and not giving him much, if anything, to do, I believe that you have the same kind of inferences raised by putting someone in a position and not giving them the tools to do it and physically placing them in a position where they actually interfere with the other people in the office. Overall, this is a case where too many explanations have to come together for it to be something other than a case where the inference of discrimination has been raised, and sufficiently so to get us to trial. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.